It's Thursday, March 28th. It's a city on water, but cities aren't supposed to black out like this. We start here. The NTSB begins investigating the ship that took down a bridge.
There are theories out there. One of those is contaminated fuel.
With interviews underway, the fuel powering the vessel is being examined. Israel says we'll meet with the Americans, but we're not happy about it.
The White House is very much trying to soothe Netanyahu right now.
The new rift reverberating all the way back to Washington. And imagine finding a stranger in your house and being told you have to leave.
Squatters aren't finding rundown houses, they're finding great houses.
Multi-million dollar houses.
New laws are taking a stand on squatting. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. It's been barely 48 hours since a huge container ship slammed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. And yet, even two full days later, there are still so many questions. Could this have been prevented? How did this ship, with the power to do so much damage, drift out of control? And what happened to the six construction workers who didn't seem to make it off that bridge? Well, we're starting to get some answers. Yesterday, two bodies were found in the Patapsco River in what appeared to be one of the vehicles on that bridge. As for the questions about the ship, well, just as an airplane has a black box, shipping vessels have a basic version of that. This one was recording everything through that collision at 1:29 in the morning on Tuesday, and now it's in the hands of investigators. Let's go straight to ABC's Sam Sweeney, who covers transportation for us. Sam, what have we learned exactly now about how this crash happened?
Brad, we are getting a clear picture now of just how quickly all of this unfolded. We learned last night from the National Transportation Safety Board that things started to go wrong at 1:24 and 59 seconds. That's when audible alarms started blaring in the bridge of the ship.
At 0:124 and 59 seconds, numerous audible alarms were recorded on the ship's audio, bridge audio. About the same time, VDR sensor data ceased recording. However, the VDR audio continued to record using the redundant power source.
Think of the bridge as the cockpit area where the captain and the pilot who's actually steering this ship, who is a local person, an expert in this area of the Patapsco River to get it out into the main water, is steering it, hearing these alarms blaring. They're trying to figure out what's going on, and that's when the power starts going in and out. We see those lights flashing on the video. Within about a minute and a half, at 1:26 and 39 seconds, that's when that pilot made a frequency call on the radio asking for tugs in the vicinity to try to help out. We now know that those tugs were never able to make it. It just happened so fast. And then at 1:27 and 4 seconds, that's when the pilot said, drop the anchors on the port side, try to slow this ship down and get it into control, when they realized things were going bad and they were barreling towards that bridge.
Around 1:27 and 25 seconds, the pilot issued a radio call over the VHF radio, reporting that the dolly had lost all power and was approaching the bridge.
Hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering.
That's when the Maryland Transportation Police officers step in. They realize how dire this is, and they shut down both lanes of traffic on both sides of the bridge.
I'm holding traffic now. I was driving, but we stopped prior to the bridge, so I'll have all out of the traffic stopped.
And luckily, they happened to be there because that construction crew was working on the bridge that night, and they were able to move in that quick and keep all of those cars from continuing to go back and forth on that bridge.
213 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Everybody, the whole bridge just collapsed.
And then by 1:29, the ship's speed was 8 miles per hour, barreling again towards that bridge. And at 1:29 and 39 seconds, that's when the pilot called in that they had hit the bridge and it had fallen.
Wow, it's unbelievably quick. Like you said, this about less than 5 minutes. Let's go through this a little bit. First, what do we know about the ship itself?
The ship was built in 2015. It's a massive cargo ship that carries, you know, more than 10,000 of these containers, similar to the back of what you would see on a tractor trailer. And it can carry anything from hazardous material to household goods. Anything can be on the ship. It was making a 27-day journey from Baltimore to Sri Lanka with 21 crew members on board.
They've also requested a number of documents, including maintenance and inspection history. And are, as we speak, conducting interviews on board the vessel.
And it has had a few problems over the years. In 2016, it needed structural repairs after it hit a wall in Belgium. And then in June of 2023, in Chile, they were written up for propulsion and an auxiliary machinery and problems with their gauges and thermometers. And that was also repaired. But overall, it's had a pretty clean record. And there was really no indication that any problem was going to take place in the hours leading up to this incident that we know of.
And you mentioned that it's not the captain steering the ship, even in this crucial moment. You said it's like the pilot who's like a local hire. It sounds like all of these people are being kept on the ship. Like the crew of the ship is still there. They're just living there because you can live there for months at a time. The NTSB is talking to all of them, I assume?
They're going to be talking to everyone. So a pilot is on board when a ship comes into a harbor or when it leaves a harbor. They are the experts. They train for this for years. They know exactly where the ship needs to steer to avoid any, you know, shallow areas. They are experts in this waterway. You got to keep in mind, these captains go into harbors all over the world. They are not the experts in these confined spaces. So the pilot comes on board when they're leaving the port and then gets on a little tugboat once they're out in the clear water and goes back and does the next ship. And yes, the NTSB will be talking to the pilot and also has already spoken with the captain for at least one interview, but you can bet they will speak to him again.
Well, and so I guess the local pilot, like they're experts in the steering, but they don't know, say, the power grid for this ship and everything, right? So is the real question here, what could have caused this power outage? Is that what was responsible for not being able to steer this?
That's the big question right now, and there are a number of theories out there. And the head of the NTSB, the chair, Jennifer Homendy, was asked this last night, and she explained, look, we don't guess what may have happened. We don't speculate. We look for facts, and when we have those facts, we will let you know.
I think it's really important for folks to understand that we will not analyze any of the information we are collecting. We will not provide any sort of findings, conclusions, or any safety recommendations while on scene. Our entire focus on scene is to collect the perishable evidence.
But again, there are theories out there. One of those is contaminated fuel. And that has happened before. Just last spring, 11 ships lost propulsion, lost their power, their steering, when there was bad fuel at a port in Houston. So that is certainly a possibility.
Just the fuel on board that's powering all the electronics, you mean?
The fuel on board. There was 1.5 million gallons of fuel on board that was going to be used to take them from Baltimore to Sri Lanka. Hmm. They're going to begin pulling samples of that fuel, and they're going to test it. Was there a problem there? Is this what shut down the engine, or was it something else?
So then let's zoom out then, because President Biden has said he will do everything he can to get this port up and running again as soon as possible. What kind of timeline are we looking at? What kind of effort are we looking at here?
Look, this is a really challenging situation, and none of the experts can give an accurate outlook yet.
There are 10 ships, according to the Department of Transportation, that are stuck in the Port of Baltimore right now. They can't get out. And of course, then no ships are coming in either. This port is closed indefinitely for marine traffic.
Think about everything that needs to happen just to get this ship out of here. You have a bridge that has mostly fallen into the water, heavy steel, concrete, and they have to clear all that out. They have to get it off of that boat. They have to inspect the ship. You know, it is resting on the bottom of the river right now because of all of the weight from the bridge that is on top of it. Oh. Once they get that off, then they have to go foot by foot on this boat underwater and inspect it. And this isn't the, you know, the Caribbean here with clear water. This is murky, muddy water. It's also freezing cold, and the visibility is about a foot. So picture this. On 9/11, you know, we saw how hard those firefighters struggled to cut through that mangled steel and that wreckage. Well, imagine doing that underwater. Mm. That's just the first portion of this. They need to clear this middle of the section of the Patapsco River out, move this bridge, and then they can begin thinking about reopening the port.
Despite this task ahead of us being daunting, I can tell you right now, our resolve is unshaken.
But you also have to remember, they have to get equipment in to do this. And there isn't exactly equipment that is powerful enough to just move bridges that's just laying around. Ultimately, the Army Corps of Engineers will be in charge of this, and they will get this job done. But they need to source the equipment, they need to get heavy-duty cranes in, they need to get barges in, they need to get people in, and they need to have a plan. And that's simply going to take time.
The scale of this, again, just boggles the mind, all right? Sam Sweeney, answering basically every question I've wanted to ask someone about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, Israeli officials are supposed to be in the U.S. right now talking out issues with the White House. So why is everyone retreating to their corners? We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
If you know anything about the United Nations, you might know that its most powerful, respected committee is the Security Council, and that within that, only a handful of countries have veto power. The U.S. is one of them. With that, the U.S. lends protections to some of its most valued allies. Like, for months, members of the Security Council have been demanding Israel implement a ceasefire in Gaza. On Israel's behalf, the U.S. has vetoed that proposal each and every time. But in recent weeks, the U.S. has also become more and more publicly frustrated with Israel, with its plans to invade the Gazan city of Rafah, with the number of Palestinians starving.
Israel also has a fundamental responsibility, though, to protect innocent civilians in Gaza.
It's now gotten to the point where the U.S. has issued its own demands for a ceasefire, and this week, when the Security Council once again voted for a ceasefire, American diplomats stood by and let that pass. That infuriated the Israeli government, resulting in canceled travel plans as diplomats in each country try to keep this relationship intact. ABC's Matt Gutman has just returned from the region. Matt, why is this such a big deal? It's not like countries at war always listen to the UN anyways.
Well, it's non-binding. It's toothless, right? The UN cannot force Israel to stop fighting in Gaza. It cannot force it to desist from this impending invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where 1.5 million people are sheltering. Many of them have been displaced, and probably a majority of them are facing starvation. But it sends a signal. And this is the first time that the U.S. has not vetoed the resolutions brought by other states. And Israel is very sensitive to that right now. They understand that the tone is shifting. President Biden landed in Israel within days of that Hamas rampage on October 7th. He gave Netanyahu a big bear hug publicly right there on the tarmac, and he embraced Israel in every possible way since then. But they can't do it anymore. It's becoming a political liability for the president, and I think it's also a moral liability. The White House has an issue with seeing people starve in Gaza, which is why they are dropping aid time and time again.
14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention.
So Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gets so hopping mad that the U.S. abstains from this UN resolution that he stops his two main emissaries, one is considered his brain, the other is the head of the National Security Council, from going to Washington to talk to top-level U.S. officials who were going to try to reason with Israel and give them some alternative approaches to this impending invasion of Rafah. So he pulled them back, and now he's saying, well, maybe they'll go, maybe they won't. Whatever's happening, I think it's emblematic of deteriorating relationships between Washington and Israel. And The White House is very much trying to soothe Netanyahu right now. They really want to get his people in a room, and they want to try to solve this Rafah issue. Netanyahu has repeated publicly again and again that he is not going to desist from this invasion of Rafah.
You cannot say you support Israel's goal of destroying Hamas and then oppose Israel when it takes the actions necessary to achieve that goal.
The reason he needs to do that is because, Brad, he promised the Israeli public that he would bring them absolute victory. If he can't provide them, Israelis, that kind of victory to be able to say, we won, mission accomplished.
I was wondering if this was like pure international politics. Israel really hates the idea that its big ally is kind of bailing on them, or if there was something more. You're saying it's more complicated. It's more about domestic politics.
Tip O'Neill said all politics is local, and I don't think there's a place where it's more true than Israel. Netanyahu's government is crumbling. He's got ministers on the left and on the right who are going to leave for various reasons. And if his government falls and he goes to new elections, he's at risk of losing the elections. There are other people who are more popular right now. Israelis, by and large, support his military efforts in the Gaza Strip. They like to see when an Israeli leader stands up to the U.S., especially when the U.S. says they can't do something. They still don't like Netanyahu, though. And that's going to be a hurdle he can't get over. His poll numbers have cratered since October 7th. People want him out. So if there are new elections and he can't hold on, he might be in the opposition. And if he's not the prime minister of Israel, he faces criminal charges for corruption, multiple serious cases, which could see him go to prison. And mind you, this is not the U.S. Just in the past decade, a former Israeli prime minister and an Israeli president have served significant prison time for crimes committed while in office. So in Israel, they take that seriously. And Netanyahu is not interested in going to jail or prison at this time.
That's interesting, because we're actually hearing from some Israeli officials that aren't Netanyahu that they think this is kind of getting blown out of proportion, that the U.S. has actually been walking a pretty normal line here. But if you're Netanyahu, you cannot be seen compromising or restraining yourself in any way right now. Really interesting. Matt Gutman covering every corner of this conflict. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Last week, our station WABC caught this all unfolding on tape.
This is my home. My locksmith is on the corner waiting to change my locks, and that's not fair.
Adele Andaloro is from New York. She was in the process of selling the home that she inherited from her late parents in Queens. But there was a problem. Some random guy was living in this house.
I may end up in handcuffs today if this man shows up here and says that I have illegally evicted him.
This appeared to be a classic case of squatting. Someone staying at a residence even as the owner is demanding they leave. In New York, if you've been in a place for 30 days, you've got what are called squatter's rights. You can only be evicted through a court judgment even if you've got no proof, no paper that you've ever signed a lease.
So Adele, you're getting arrested right now?
I'm being arrested.
For what?
For being in my own home.
And where's your lease?
She's fighting the house. It's not her house anymore.
My deed is current and legal.
Well, in recent months, more and more states have entertained legislation that would hand power and keys back to homeowners. And yesterday in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis signed the nation's most aggressive bill into law. ABC's Jacqueline Lee has been covering this for a while. She's actually in Miami right now. Jacqueline, how bad has squatting become recently?
Well, Brad, we're really kind of seeing this almost as a squatting epidemic. Across all of these different states, you're seeing people take advantage of tenant rights.
A luxurious house in the Hollywood Hills taken over by squatters.
Squatters have been living here for a few months, throwing wild parties.
Squatters suspected of killing a woman and then stuffing her body into a duffel bag.
They break into these homes, say that they live there, whether or not they have a lease with the home, and then all of a sudden they live there and the homeowner has no recourse. So what you're seeing is a lot of homeowners are getting frustrated because they cannot get rid of them. Law enforcement is called to the property. Law enforcement can't actually do anything because they refer to this as a civil matter, forcing the homeowners to go through the court system to get rid of these people who shouldn't even be in their homes, which can take months, if not years, depending on the state. So you're seeing homeowners frustrated, law enforcement's hands are tied, and that's why we're seeing lawmakers start to get involved.
I see. Because I understand, I guess, why these laws were initially made, right? These squatters' rights are so that a slumlord can't come in and change the locks on a tenant when there's some minor disagreement. You don't want homeless people on the street. And yet, here, this sounds like very savvy, brazen people at this point.
Correct. These are people who are actively finding loopholes in the law, exploiting that, and living in these properties at the expense of homeowners who are actually paying the taxes and the mortgage, etc.
Oh my gosh. Literally 1 year ago this time, I walked up and saw pit bulls on it, and the house was in shambles.
In Jacksonville, Florida, there's a woman named Patty Peoples. She owns a few rental properties, and she decided to sell one of them.
Owning an extra home was just my way of getting a little bit of extra income for my retirement.
When she went to go sell it, it was actually under contract. They were going to close. And when her handyman arrived at the home, he discovered there were some people living in the home. They had changed the locks.
And it only got worse when the police arrived. He gave me the really devastating news was that this had to be managed in civil court.
Patty then confronted them.
You're going to vacate?
Yeah.
Oh, no, of course. I'm not going to vacate.
I had several more altercations with the squatters.
I own the house, ma'am.
I don't care what you own. We talked to the police yesterday, and they handled it.
And most of those were caught on videotape with me videotaping for my own safety.
There was a physical altercation. The people would not leave, and they actually called the police on her.
I own the house. I don't have to go anywhere by law.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
They physically threw her out of the house.
I'm not touching you.
You are touching me. And this lady is touching me.
And law enforcement said to her, you know, actually, if you do this again, we are going to arrest you.
I cannot tell you the frustration I felt at this point.
Because these people are claiming that they have a lease, but it was not true whatsoever. They just happened to break in and bring in all their belongings.
But from the police's perspective, they're like, well, this person was here first, Patty. Sorry.
Correct.
So like, you're the trespassing one.
There's no way for police to corroborate. Therefore, that is why police send it to the courts as a civil matter.
So the squatters did about $40,000 worth of damage on the inside. The neighbors could hear them in there with sledgehammers. It was a complete and total disaster.
Okay, so, I mean, following the legal pathway that's laid out for you by the courts, that can take weeks or months. What other options do you have, I guess? Like, what are people resorting to?
Yes, and the legal way can actually even take years, like in New York, because there's such a backlog in the courts. So I'm glad you brought that up, because in Los Angeles, there's someone named Flash Shelton. He calls himself the Squatter Hunter.
If somebody finds a loophole and figures that they have rights and they can live rent-free and, you know, think about how much money all of us would have if we didn't have to pay mortgage or rent.
What he does is he is hired by homeowners who are dealing with squatters to come in and out-squat the squatters. So, for example, this all happened because in 2019, his mom was trying to sell her property and someone broke in, moved in all of their furniture and their belongings, and would not leave.
I actually had a lease written in my name by my mom because I had heard some squatters have fake leases. And I got up there and I waited for them to leave and I put up cameras. When they returned, I gave them the choice of leaving with their furniture or leaving without.
And he will make life as miserable as possible for the squatters living inside.
So yeah, I mean, squatters aren't finding rundown houses. They're finding great houses.
Multi-million dollar houses,
yeah.
In the Hollywood Hills, he was hired by an elderly woman who was a widow.
My name is Flash. And I understand you've been squatting at this residence.
He films all this. He puts it on his YouTube channel.
I am taking over this property. I am leasing this property, and I'm moving my crew in.
He had this lease from the homeowner, and he told the squatter, well, I'm moving in, and I'm filming a reality show, and you're going to be on it because you won't leave this house.
And so if the squatter's like, I have a lease, I get to stay here, then he's also like, well, I have a lease. And so, great, we'll just both be here.
Exactly. And that's how he takes advantage of the legal system to get rid of someone who was also taking advantage of said legal system.
Wow, which is wild, because every police officer or authority involved here would say, do not confront or engage these people. Like, there have been violent incidents stemming from this stuff. So if you don't have a squatter hunter, what can be done on, like, the state level? What are the provisions in some of these new laws?
So, frankly, Florida is really paving the way.
We are in the state of Florida ending the squatter scam once and for all. And
The bill that Governor Ron DeSantis signed, it allows property owners to request law enforcement to remove a squatter from the property if the following conditions are met. Number one, a person has unlawfully entered and remains on the property. Number two, a person has been directed to leave the property by the owner but has not done so. And number three, a person is not a current or former tenant in a legal dispute. So if those three conditions are met, now these squatters are going to face criminal charges. Trespassers will be charged with a felony for intentional damage. Falsifying a lease carries a misdemeanor charge. And if someone tries to sell a homeowner's property, it's a first-degree felony. So you're really seeing a crackdown on squatters taking advantage of the system.
Every time I talk about it, it brings back all of the memories. Or if I look at some of the old videos.
Going back to Patty Peoples, who was the homeowner in Jacksonville, who helped spur this legislation, she's hoping this is a blueprint for other states to follow suit.
I do feel a little better when I think, well, this issue was used for change, and I'm really grateful at that.
We're seeing, you know, lawmakers in New York and Georgia even put forth legislation to try to clarify the difference between a tenant and a squatter.
Yeah, and so often when you hear about Florida governor and the New York governor, or the California governor, you think they're going to disagree about things. I mean, this bill in Florida passed unanimously. You got New York and Georgia and Florida considering very similar laws. It's become a very bipartisan sense of anger over what's been happening with a lot of these houses. All right, Jacqueline Lee, there in Miami. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, how much is 1 second? Enough to make things awkward. One last thing is next.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
And one last thing. It seems pretty simple. A day is a day, right? One rotation of the Earth. There are 365 of them in a year. But think about it. A year isn't exactly 365 days. This is why we have leap years. We gotta add a day to make up for the fact that our planet doesn't neatly align with our numbers. Well, yesterday, a geophysicist at UC San Diego came out with a paper asserting that days can get longer or shorter because of climate change. So here's a little background I did not know. Apparently, the rotation of the Earth is not as consistent as we'd like to think. Because of stuff like the moon and Earth's own core, our days can actually speed up and slow down by just a fraction of a second. To most of us, it's no big deal, but to the Earth's official timekeepers, atomic clocks, it's huge. Think about computer networks or satellites. They need to understand exactly where they are at a certain time to ascertain where you are. So 50 years ago, these timekeepers came up with the idea of a leap second. Every few years, they'd update clocks around the world, adding a second to make up for the fact that the Earth was slowing its spin. Lately, though, the planet has been speeding up, and they plan to take a second away from us for the first time. But now, they might have to make another adjustment. I'm not making this up, because global warming has made the Earth a bit fatter.
The sea level rise in the southeastern United States and the Gulf of Mexico has come up to unprecedented levels.
Picture all the ice at the North and South Pole. You know how it's turning into water recently? Well, that doesn't stay stationary. It travels towards the Earth's equator, meaning we're a little chubbier, we're a little soggy around the midsection. That is slowing down what had been a speeding rotation. So what does it all mean? Well, it is the first time scientists have asserted climate change could affect the literal motion of the planet, and it means that second might not be taken away from us for a few more years. Your day just got a couple tenths of a second longer, and now you spent a couple minutes learning why. I didn't know this. Apparently, we had added 27 seconds to this planet in the last half century. This was going to be like the Earth going, give that back. Climate change has literally been like, no, we will hold on to that time. Thank you very much. Signed, humans. I'm Brad Milkey. I'm going to stop taking any more of your time. I'll see you tomorrow.
When Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 Central on ABC.